I'm Cal Levy, and I started working with Electric Factory Concerts in 1975.
What was Electric Factory Productions?
The company I worked for in Cincinnati was originally called Riverfront Concerts in 1975.
So it merged?
It was a joint venture with Electric Factory, and at the end of 1978, the option was there for Electric Factory to purchase the entire operation, which they did. So in early 1975, Riverfront Concerts ceased to exist, and it became Electric Factory Concerts.
And your position with Riverfront and Electric Factory remained the same? What was
No, when I was first hired, I was hired as a production manager. I was hired a couple of days before the first show, the Allman Brothers show in 1975, for which I stuffed trash cans and made sure that the band had what they needed. And then I progressed through the company to the point where when I came back after a year in Los Angeles in late 1977, I was, for lack of a better term, the office manager and promoter. I was the on-site representative for the company.
You mentioned Allman Brothers Band. Do some name dropping. Who else came through town while you were on board there?
Paul McCartney and Wings, Elton John, Peter Frampton, Kiss, Bob Seger, Dave Mason, the Beach Boys, Frank Sinatra, Elton John. From my best recollections, about everybody that I could remember except Pink Floyd and the Stones. I wasn't here in 1977, the year Led Zeppelin was there, so I didn't get to work with them. But most, if not all, the other top rock acts of the day, and a lot of the non-rock acts of the day, came through that building in the first 4 or 5 years.
You mentioned Sinatra. Who were some of the other non-rock acts?
Sammy Davis Jr. There was 3 or 4 jazz acts we put together. Some R&B acts, the Spinners, the OJs, the Commodores. Acts like that. Elvis. Can't forget Elvis.
Oh, yes.
Can't forget Elvis in March of 1976.
What do you remember about that Elvis Presley show?
The first thing that struck me was that it was a two-show situation in the same day with one of them being a matinee. I couldn't get my hands around that in the beginning. Of course, they both sold out in no time at all. It was basically produced by a company called Concerts West. And as the local rep, we babysat the show, which in this case was insanely easy because, as the stories tell, Elvis didn't come in till right before he went on stage. He came in an unmarked sedan.
From the carousel. He was staying at the carousel,
yeah.
If I remember right.
Came in an unmarked sedan. His dressing room contained all of 6 glasses of Coke with ice. And it was just an amazing thing because you see rock acts and their audiences and how they respond and everything. And you hear about Elvis, and then you see it, and it's not to be believed. I mean, he was amazing. He was great with the people backstage. You know, this is about the time when he was giving cars away to stagehands and to police and all this kind of stuff. And so everybody was kidding with him backstage. And the matinee came and went. We went home, had dinner, came back down, did the evening show. And as they say, Elvis left the building because he does. As soon as he walks off the stage, he's back in the car, out to Lunken on his plane, and he had wheels up probably before most people were back out on the concourse. It was an easy day, but it was a really exciting day.
Sounds like that may have been one of, I was going to ask, when you were running through all those names, all those rock acts, what would be the highlight of all the acts that you witnessed there? I would imagine that just the, maybe not the concert itself, but the situation of Elvis had to have been up top. The
situation for Elvis was incredible. McCartney was incredible. It was his first tour. It was the Wings Over America tour in May of 1976. I had the opportunity to go in and spend 20 minutes with he and Linda, which was mind-boggling. I almost swallowed my tongue. I mean, I was in there talking to a Beatle. I didn't know. That was tremendously exciting. Elton John was very exciting. He just lit up not only the arena, but the backstage area. There were a lot of acts that really set us on our ear. Those two stand out for me. Plus some other personal favorites like Seeger and the Eagles were a favorite of mine.
Do you recall how your day started on December 3rd of 79?
Yeah, I do. It was different in that my boss, Larry Magid, decided to come in from Philadelphia, which I think it might have been the only trip, maybe one other trip he made in the whole time from 1975 to 1980, because the Who's manager, Bill Kerbishley, was on the tour. So Larry came in, And the day started with conversations with him when he got to Stouffer's. And then my usual routine. I'd go down to the arena in the morning, check with the production manager, make sure the breakfast catering had been taken care of, walk around the building, just say hello to the stagehands, and then go back to the office till about 5 o'clock when Larry and I went down to the show. The only thing I remember getting to the Coliseum was the wind and the cold. It seemed pretty cold that day, even for December.
1979, the world of rock and roll. Who is it? The Who and the Stones. They're at the top, right?
They were at the top.
Led Zeppelin.
Zeppelin, too.
Yeah. Who, Stones, and Zeppelin. So you have one of the top three bands in the world in right. town. Where'd your day go from there?
Once I got there at 5, I went and did my rounds, said hello to Richard Morgan, the building manager, walked up to the inside area of the plaza, which I always did a tour just one time around. Again, talked to my production manager, talked to the caterer, talked to a representative of The who told me that they might be late arriving at the building, but it shouldn't interfere with the sound check. We were only the second date on the tour, on that leg of the tour. So they were coming out of Pittsburgh, and as is the case in many, many tours, the first night loadout just doesn't go as expected. So things were running a little slower, a little behind pace from their standpoint, but nothing that anybody was concerned about. And then Larry went to dinner with Frank Wood up in the Beehive Club, and I sat in my office, waited for it to be showtime, which is what I always did. Grabbed a little dinner from the crew catering and just hung out.
Most everybody come in through Lunken in those days, or did it depend?
No, it depended. The Who were flying commercial, because I know when they left in US Air to go to Rhode Island. It just depended on the act.
So they're a little bit late. You're in your office. When was it discovered? When did you discover, and how did you discover that something terrible had happened outside?
I got a call from Richard Morgan.
And he is who?
He's the building manager. Prior to that, there had been a call on the radio that the ambulance, the paramedics that we had hired, that we always brought to rock shows on our own, were needed upstairs. That was not in and of itself in a rock show a rarity, because some kids had a habit of getting too high. So it wasn't terribly unusual on a rock show to have somebody wheeled past us in the hallway backstage, because it's the only way they could get them outside, with oxygen, with a bag, needing assistance. If I remember correctly, about 7:45, I got a call from Richard that he needed to see me upstairs. That's all he said.
So your office is
my office is on the ground floor, and the plaza level, I think, is the third floor.
A couple flights, yeah.
Maybe the fourth floor. The offices are the third floor, yeah. And so Bo Wood was with me, and he said, "You want me to go with you?" I said, "Sure, why not? Don't know what's going on." And so I had knee surgery, and I was having knee problems. Tried to take the elevator, couldn't, because it was packed with suite holders and people coming in to get to the concert. So we walked the steps and walked out the door into the concourse and then onto the plaza level, where we saw, well, we didn't know exactly what had transpired, but what we saw was utter chaos.
No one had mentioned to you yet what the problem was.
No, they just asked me to come upstairs.
So you're on the plaza.
Yeah. I walked outside, and I saw emergency vehicles everywhere. I saw news crews everywhere. I saw shoes and coats and bits of clothing and bodies and people working on those bodies. And I just stood there, frozen. Saw the mayor, the new mayor, first day on the job, Mayor Blackwell. Saw him walking around. Bumped into Dale Menkhouse, asked him what he knew. He didn't know much. He just said something about there had been some deaths on the plaza, probably caused by asphyxiation.
How did the mayor, all the emergency folks, show up before you even got the word? Before you even, you were summoned to the building manager's office, but without information, correct?
Correct.
How did they all show up that quick before the word even got to you?
Well, when the doors opened and the crowd filtered in, there was a 40-minute gap between that and when I got a call. So there was plenty of time.
This is pre-cell phone days.
Correct, oh, yeah.
Correct. So it's all landline phones. That's okay. I'm
so there was plenty of time for the people to make their way into the building and for the tragedy to unfold, for everybody to see what was going on or what had happened. And so in that space of time, my guess is Dale Menkhouse told Richard what was going on. Everybody immediately called for as much help as they could. Richard had whatever duties he had to do and take care of and inform the people he had to inform. And then they called me.
The number 11 is what sticks in everybody's mind. That was the number of deaths, was it not?
Correct.
Were there injuries besides that? A number of injured and serious?
Yeah, there was broken bones, contusions.
How many? Dozens?
I want to say maybe 20, but I'm not positive. There were people that passed out for various reasons and were being attended to, but I know there were some injuries involved.
You book a band, you book a show. Some shows are reserved seating, some shows are festival. How is it decided because of the stature of the band? And these days it's a Springsteen, I guess, sort of thing. Matter of fact, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Springsteen has done festival seating shows here since then. But how was it decided back then how to sell seats?
It starts with the band. A lot of the bands wanted the closeness that festival seating provides, the freeness in the atmosphere that festival seating provides.
Again, the sign of the times.
Sign of the times, as opposed to Bob Seger, who is considered a rock and roll act, not a hard rock act, but a rock and roll act. He would only have reserve seating when he headlined. It was strictly a situation where the act would talk to Larry Magid, or their agency would talk to Larry. Larry would call, and I'd research the date availabilities first. Then we'd talk about the type of seating, which dictated the capacity, work out the pricing, set it up with the building, who set it up with Ticketron at that time, I believe. It wasn't a call that anyone had except for the band, unless a specific building, and this was the case in some parts of the country, only did reserve seating shows, or certain capacities only dictated festival seating because you're going to sell fewer tickets on a reserve seat show than you are on a festival seating show. And if a band wants to play that market, or a promoter wants to try to get the band to play that market, and there's a certain dollar figure involved, that's how you get there.
What happened on that night of the 30th December in 79, and I think we've talked about this before, could very, very easily have happened at any number of venues in the entire country.
Anytime, any place, any city, anywhere. There's a mixture of things that go into a crowd. Some are good and some are bad. There were other situations, other nights, where it was warmer and a crowd acted up, threw things through the windows of the doorways of the Coliseum, kicked windows in because they wanted to get in, and other days when there was no problems at all. Yeah, it could have happened anywhere. It just happened to happen here.
How long were you there that night?
I don't think I left until maybe 1 o'clock in the morning, somewhere around there. It was later than I would normally stay at a show.
Had 11 passed away by then, or did they all pass away relatively?
Yeah, I don't believe there were any that were in a condition such that they passed away the next day or the day after. These kids were asphyxiated, stepped on, whatever, on the spot. By the time I left, I believe the number was at 11. I didn't know any names, but I believe it was at 11. Yeah.
Changes have been implemented since then, as far as festival seating, as far as, I guess, safety procedures.
Right.
Did it go into effect immediately? How did these things evolve? How did they, the changes that were?
We had a meeting in the city manager's office about a week after the show where we suspended any concerts that we had booked at that time.
What were they and how many? Do you remember?
At that point, there were two in December. One was ours and one was Belkin's. It was Aerosmith and Blue Oyster Cult.
Do you know if either had been festival seating?
I think both would have been festival seating. There was a moratorium, an agreed-to moratorium. I mean, we weren't going
unanimous.
We weren't going to go ahead with anything it was well known and well spoken that the city wanted changes, not just in the seating aspect of it, but in the operations of the Coliseum in general and concerts in general. Because while we did most of the concerts, we didn't do all the concerts. So we just waited for the mayor's task force, not the crowd control task force. The mayor had a task force, and there were public hearings held. We waited for that to play out. And when we were given the changes and a time frame under which they were comfortable to resume doing concerts, we went and booked our first two concerts in March of 1980.
And who were they?
Linda Ronstadt and ZZ Top were the first two.
Going into those concerts, what were your feelings? Were you antsy? Were you...
Well, yeah. I mean, there was no way I couldn't be. A lot of it goes back to what was happening to me in that time period, living in town. And a lot of it was an obvious question as to how the concert goers were going to react to the building being open for business again. There was no way to know. This is a very conservative town, and it was more so back in 1979. And a lot of people that go to concerts are kids, and their parents have to allow them to go to the concerts. There was a definite stigma attached to the building now, for better or worse, festival seating or non-festival seating. It still was known countrywide as the building where the 11 kids were killed at a Who concert.
There's a moratorium on concerts there. Were other events being held, circus or anything?
I don't remember.
Do you recall?
No. I honestly don't remember. It's around the time where there should have been some family shows, but those were all reserve seating.
Like a Holiday on Ice or those sorts of things.
Yeah. I don't think those were affected. There was a permit process put in place for everything. So certain forms and questions had to be answered before the city would allow anything to go on anyway. And you're going to have, obviously, a whole different set of circumstances with a Disney show or an ice show than you are with a rock concert. Mm-hmm.
The band was told when?
The band was told after they finished playing.
Had they done an encore? Had they just left the stage and they were told, and so they didn't go back out?
Told after their encore.
Okay.
They were told when they were finished playing, their manager went in and told them. Yeah.
Who told the manager? Did you?
Yeah, Larry and I. Yeah.
What was his reaction?
As everyone else, he was stunned. He was shocked. He didn't know. I mean, this is brand new territory for everybody. This wasn't Altamont, where Hell's Angels security guard flew off the handle and killed somebody, or an overdose, which had happened in various places, I'm sure. This was a significant event. He was very concerned about how he was going to break it to the band.
Were you able to see them before they left?
I only saw them as they left.
As they left.
Because we sent some of our larger peer T-shirt security guys with them to Stouffer's, because obviously the media wanted a piece. I talked to their head of security, Jim Callahan, great guy. They hired a handful of our guys that went back and manned the elevators and the rooms on the floor where the band was staying until they left the next day. I never spoke to anybody in the band about it.
What about your career from that point? How did it change? What changed?
From a career standpoint?
From a concert promoter career, yeah.
It was an interesting time. It was very strange to me what was going on. I mean, there were two things in play. There was what was going on with me in the city, where, for lack of a better phrase, I was the one left behind. Electric Factory went back to Philadelphia. The Who went on tour.
Electric Factory left town?
The company's based in Philadelphia.
Yeah. But they were no longer in Cincinnati?
No. I mean, okay. Larry went.
Okay.
Yeah. It became my job to babysit what was going on from a media standpoint, to assist the attorneys, because the first lawsuit was filed somewhere like 48 hours afterwards.
By one of the deceased family?
Yes. Oh. And what that does is clams everybody up. There shouldn't have been any real discussion about it. There was, but from a career standpoint, as the months progressed, as we got into 1980, I started getting job offers to leave Cincinnati because I was viewed as having taken the hit, but stood up against an unbelievable barrage of media and pressure.
Assault.
That's a good word. And I thought I was good at what I did anyway. I put everything I did into my job. So it was strange for me to be getting job offers at the same time I was getting death threats on my kids because kids had died. I did some interviewing just to check it out. But
when you say job, you're talking about concert promoter job.
Yeah, okay. Working for concert promoters in other parts of the country, taking care of other territories for other people. At the end of the day, it didn't make sense to me knowing how much time I'd probably have to spend back in Cincinnati anyway on this. Plus, I'm not a runner. I had known that I myself did not play a part in what happened and all the blame that was being thrown around and all the grief against the nature of the business that I had been part of for the last 5 years on a major scale since the Coliseum had opened. I wanted to see that through. And so my wife and I decided, you can move. You're going to have to come back. The lawyer said, there'll be depositions. There'll be this. There'll be that. You're not going to be able to get away from it anywhere. If you go to a new market, you're going to be labeled as the guy that came from Cincinnati and the Who concert, which is true, because that follows me today. I get that off and on today, even still, well, especially with Google. For the first few months, I had no concert business. I was honed in on watching the media, listening to the reports, meeting with the attorneys, sifting through what was out there that was real and what was crap, who might have been saying what they needed to say because they felt they needed to say it, and just working with the attorneys.
How soon before you got an attorney? Or had you had one prior to this incident? The company did, but yeah, did you personally?
My attorney was the company's attorney locally, but then the insurance company's attorney entered into it, obviously, because that's where this was going to go. So I worked with them all the time. But the company decided to retain my personal attorney as the company's attorney throughout all this.
Electric Factory.
Yeah, locally. They had their own attorneys in Philadelphia, but locally.
Is there such a thing as Electric Factory anymore? Concert Promotions? Or how long did they last?
I think the name still exists. I think they were part of the mass promoter buyout that went on over the space of the last 10 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I got out of the concert business in 1984 after I worked for 1 year at Riverbend.
In a promoter capacity?
I was one of the general managers. Niederlander family were the promoters. Then I got into sports.
How did you deal with this? How did you deal with this personally?
I was flipped out. The night it happened, I called my wife and told her to call her brother in Columbus. I had two small kids, one that had just been born 2 months prior, who was possibly very ill. We didn't know at that point yet. And about a 3-year-old son. And I said, pack them up. I'll have a car there tomorrow morning. Take them to Columbus for at least a week. Because this will get crazy. And I don't want to be around anybody. I don't want to have to make excuses for how I'm acting or behaving or the mood I'm in or whatever. And it's just best for everybody to be gone for a while. So we set that up and they left the next morning. The fact that I had two young kids really hit hard to me. Because as time went on, as the discussion started about the lawsuits when they were first filed, the total, I was sued for $132 million. Very crazy amount of money. But I started to learn that, and I hadn't known this before that, you can't put an earnings, potential earnings value on a minor. When you get to calculating the damages, you by nature legally decrease the worth of that life. From a monetary standpoint, that flipped me out. I think it was called at the time the worthless child doctrine. Like I said, I received calls, death threats on my kids. I had a hard time going anywhere without people knowing, pointing, and even picking up my dry cleaning when they'd call my name. It was a very strange situation. Not that I'd hidden from the media all my life, because I haven't. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know that. I'd given interviews on things before, and we had done the stadium show the year before. So I had my share of media exposure, but people that knew me tended to feel very sorry for me, which wasn't necessarily what I needed when I look back on it. I was avoided for a while with no bad intentions, but I was a different guy for a while. All I did was watch the TV and read the newspapers and listen to the radio and not answer messages on this, refer them to my lawyer. I walked in the morning after, there were over 200 messages on with the answering service we had, which is natural. I can't even imagine. I thought about this a lot. I can't even imagine if this would have happened in 1989 with the advent of 24-hour news and the USA Today and all the different media that sprang up in the 80s. Because you see what they make out of events, however catastrophic or not catastrophic at the end of the day, you see what happens. This was a catastrophic event. This was a mind-bending, precedent-setting situation. And this was uncharted territory for me. So I just tried to get through it the best I can. I was not the same person, no doubt.
But you dealt with it. You dealt with it for years and years and years. You went through, I guess, trials and lawsuits.
Well, there were no trials.
No, nothing like that?
No. It was settled in 1984. It was settled out of court for some, I'm not sure about this. I think it was $2.2
million. $2.2
million
to who?
Most of it went
to... It was spread out between 11?
Yeah, and the injuries. The biggest part of that going to the family who lost the mom that died, had a young kid. I had a lot of problems with it. In February, I was in a real tough state of denial, real hardcore state of denial, because my defenses were up. And then WKRP in Cincinnati did an episode about the concert. And I was promoting Prince that night at Bogart's. But I waited because I wanted to see, this was before DVRs and all that, I waited to see it. And it had a great impact on me.
I didn't see it. What was it?
They
was
just
it, was
treated
it poorly
it,
done?
No, it was very well done.
Oh, was it?
In fact, I talked to them afterwards. It was very well done. It didn't point fingers. It talked about festival seating, which makes sense. But it was very well done. And it was this air of them all coming back to the studio, shock and awe, which was exactly how we were.
Were you consulted or anything on this?
No.
Was anybody from here locally consulted,
no.
You know?
Not that I know of. That episode forced me to seek psychiatric help. It broke down my defenses a little bit, and I went for a little while and saw a doctor, and that kind of leveled me out a little bit. And then I got on with my life. My depositions were in end of March, I think, maybe the beginning of April. I don't exactly remember the dates. 2 days. That was an amazing process. I was on the defense a lot. You watch all these legal shows on television, all these cops and robbers shows, and it's pretty much like that. Now, I had never been grilled by an attorney before for anything. They take the sum of what they want to take and what they want to find out, and they want to know if what you're going to say matches up with other people that have already given their depositions, which some of it by nature can't because we all were not in the same place at the same time. And they try to reference conversations that did or didn't happen. And it was an amazing 2 days. It was an unbelievable 2 days.
Where'd this take place?
Cincinnati Club, or it was in Garfield Place. After that, from what I remember, after the depositions, it was kind of calm until David Lee Roth came into town and asked everybody to flick their lighters, which is, I think, the third concert. Then it all kind of ratcheted up again for a little while, and I couldn't believe it.
Had you ever had the chance or the opportunity to speak with any family members of those who died?
No. I was instructed by the attorneys not to send anything to any of the memorials or the funerals. One of the things that got to me about what happened when they released the names, one of the kids was Peter Bowes in Wyoming. I had spent a few hours with his older brother, Ben, a week before, maybe. with a mutual friend. And that was hard. I think I talked to Ben on the phone briefly. Past that, until the litigation was settled, and that took 5 years, nobody contacted me. I was instructed, as long as I worked for the company, not to contact anybody. So I didn't. There were a couple of times I talked to the newspapers where I expressed all that I could express from a personal level. You can't say you're sorry for someone's loss 7 different ways. It doesn't ease up because it gets further away from the event in that regard. When you're part of something like that, you carry it with you. It's part of who you are. It's classic wrong place, wrong time syndrome, because as we said, it could have happened anywhere. It happened on my watch.
And you carried it with you, and you carried it with you, and I guess, let's see, that was litigation was 4 years afterwards, did you say?
Well, it was settled. Yeah. There was never any real litigation.
So that's 84 or so?
Yeah. There were never any trials. I don't remember ever being called back to be deposed again. It just sat there, and they gathered all their information and negotiated.
Well, then 4 years after that, you had a stroke and went through some...
Well, 14 years after that.
Oh, I thought it was 88. Was it 98?
No, it was 98.
Okay.
It was 98.
Can we talk a little bit about what you mentioned before we started recording?
Yeah, sure.
About therapy and...
The therapy I had after the stroke, obviously that was one of the things I talked about. I was still carrying the guilt. I still carry the guilt, but to a much lesser extent. It's not so much a guilt now as it is a sadness.
I don't think that's something you'll ever get rid of, I don't think. That's sad. That sadness part of it.
Yeah.
How could you?
Yeah. And the therapist convinced me that as long as I believed and as long as I knew, let me go back for a second. Mm-hmm. I was the first defendant dropped as a defendant from the litigation. And that happened not that long after my deposition.
Now go back again. You were the first, but who were the rest, the other defendants?
The city, in some of the cases, the band, the Coliseum, Electric Factory Concerts, Tidal Wave Productions, which is the Who's management company. I think those were the major ones.
And you?
And me, individually.
Individually.
Because I was on site. And because it was thought at that time that I made the calls, which wasn't the case.
Okay, I interrupted you. You were the first one dropped.
Yeah, I was the first one dropped. I feel that was a combination of two things. My deposition showed that I played no part in the process under which they were going to proceed with the lawsuits. Plus, I had no money. Can't get blood from a stone. And I know that that plays a part in any litigation where there's more than one defendant. I'd like to think it's because they knew I had no place. Because they knew I was covered by the insurance of the company anyway. But I was dropped as a defendant. But when I went through this therapy, I finally broke free of the guilt part of it to the point where I threw away my copies of the depositions. I threw away most of the newspaper clippings. And it was important for me because of what I had undergone with the stroke to clean that out, to clean that and some other things out, just get rid of it and get on with my life and heal. And I was lucky enough that I did recover from the stroke.
Over what period of time did you do that therapy? Months, a year, a couple months.
A couple months. In the when was the stroke? Stroke was in April of 98. I came home a month later. Yeah, late spring, early summer of 98. I was not in the concert business for quite a while by then. But
you were with the Reds at the time, weren't you?
I was with the Reds, and I owned my own company. The Reds had hired me as a consultant, my company as a consultant. Mm. Yeah.
Was it something you were aware of, that guilt being lifted from you at the time? Or is it something you can look back on and say, that's about when that happened? Or was it a feeling you had after a therapy session or after therapy was done that you said, I just feel better?
Being able to throw out the materials, because I swore at that time that was, I don't need to revisit it again. I don't need to bring myself to that. That was, I guess, as symbolic as you're going to get for me. But like I said, it's part of me. It is what it is. I think the whole experience, the whole situation taught the music business that they can't take things for granted. Because in almost any business and in almost anything, until something goes wrong, you do what works. You dance with who you brung. And this was a very rude awakening across the whole spectrum of the industry. And I just happened to be in the middle of it.
Where are you today and what are you doing?
I'm playing with my grandkids. I'm playing with my dogs. We moved to Columbus a couple of years ago after the Castellinis bought the Reds. My contract was not renewed. So I retired. I have a neurological disease called peripheral neuropathy, which attacks the nerves in your feet first and works up your legs. So I'm on Social Security disability. But there's been some great treatment on that, so that's getting better.
Is that any kind of result of the stroke at all or nothing to do with it?
They don't think so. They don't know. Mine is what they call idiopathic, no known. Could have been. I mean, I've had six back operations, too. So my spinal column is, my central nervous system is saltines anyway. And I'm just doing what comes up, living outside of Columbus.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been very enlightening for me. I really appreciate you doing this.
No problem.
I really do. That was Cal Levy, one of the promoters of the Who concert at Riverfront Coliseum on December 3rd, 1979. The Who, in early 2010, will be the special halftime act at the Super Bowl in Miami on February 7th. Stay tuned now for a one-hour special on the Who concert, 30 years later. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Brian O'Donnell. Tommy, can you hear me? Can you feel me near you? Tommy, can you see me? Can I help to cheer you? Ooh, Tommy, 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 can you hear me? Can you feel me near you? Tommy, can you see me? Can I help to cheer you? Ooh, Tommy, 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 can you hear me? Can you feel me near you? Tommy, can you see me? Can I help to cheer you? Oh, Tommy, 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 Tommy,
Tommy, Tommy, Tommy, Tommy. Hello!